From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a post-Katrina energy bill intended to boost the nation's oil refining capacity passed in the House last Friday by an eked-out margin, 212 to 210. The vote itself, scheduled for 5 minutes, turned into a 48-minute strong-arm session, with GOP leaders leaning hard on resistant Republicans and opposing Democrats shouting, shame, shame. The bill's proponents say that the Gasoline for America's Security Act, or GAS Act, gives much-needed encouragement to up processing capacity in the U.S., where a new refinery has not been built since 1976. It makes federal military land available for new refinery construction, cuts pollution controls, and encourages new pipeline construction. Critics say it's a giveaway to big oil and an environmental sellout. Supporters say it's about getting real. The Senate may never pass it, but oil prices are up and so are political temperatures over what to do. This hour On Point, making energy policy under the gun on Capitol Hill. We'll look at the debate. You can join the conversation. What did you see in the crunch time energy policy making on Capitol Hill last week? And what future do you see emerging in America's energy crisis management? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In a moment, I'll be joined by Washington Post congressional reporter Jonathan Wiseman, and later in the hour, we'll hear from a Republican congressman who supported the legislation. But first, we turn to one of the 13 House Republicans who voted against the new GOP bill. Joining me now from Wilmington, Delaware, is Representative Michael Castle of Delaware. He voted against the GAS Act. Congressman Castle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Why did you vote against this act?
First of all, I voted against the earlier energy bill as well, Tom. I felt that this particular bill actually was harmful in an environmental sense. I felt that it did very little to really produce more oil or gas or even coal, for all that matters. But at the other hand, I thought it had a number of items included in it which would have given financial relief to these entities, all of which are probably the highest earning companies in America today. And I also felt that we didn't speak to the issues of alternative sources of energy, which has to be the future. I just didn't think it was a very holistic approach to these problems and didn't meet the goal of trying to reduce heating and gasoline prices immediately.
The pressure, even the hammer, Tom DeLay himself came down hard on people who, Republicans, who were resisting the vote. You managed to hold out, others did not. How tough was the pressure in the chamber last week?
You know, that's an interesting question because I never spoke to anybody during that entire vote or even before it. I checked no on the whip check, and that was the last I heard of it. So I received no pressure at all. Obviously, they were working on people they felt were more inclined to change their votes, and eventually they were able to get those votes changed.
You told the Washington Post it was a heck of a performance to turn this around. The lesson was that nothing's changed, and I guess by that you mean the GOP vice on its own party, the party discipline, can still be brought down hard.
Well, that's correct. I spoke to Jonathan Wiseman of the Post about this, and he asked me the question, well, was it different without Tom DeLay being the majority leader and being the hammer of the whip in this, if you will. Mm-hmm. Even though he's a majority leader, he's the leading whipper. And basically, it was not. I mean, the lessons have been learned and taught by Tom DeLay in terms of how to do this, and they went about their business, and they got the job done. It obviously took longer than they would have liked, and usually that's an indication that the bill's not all that popular. But they did it, and there really wasn't a great change over the Tom DeLay whip in majority days.
Congressman, what do you think the passage of this act says about American energy policy and how it's going to be shaped as the pressure rises with the problems along the Gulf Coast, with higher energy prices? Is this the new pattern that we're going to see? The crisis is on, the heat is on, and so things get done quickly for, controversial reasons.
Here's what I hope, Tom. I did not like this piece of legislation. As I said, I didn't think it was holistic enough. We really need to start to focus on energy in this country. We need to, first of all, have our car manufacturers do a lot more than they've been doing. The poor showing of American automobile manufacturers in hybrid cars is an indication of our problems. We don't change CAFE standards. We keep dealing with bigger and bigger cars without doing much about it. We're not doing enough in terms of conservation with respect to home heating, all the various measures that could be taken. We're just tremendous consumers. But I think as important as anything, we're not really looking at the alternative sources of energy. Even here in Delaware, we have a GE solar plant, for example. We're looking at cell storage, all kinds of different things that can be done. Eventually, hydrogen as far as cars are concerned. These are the kinds of things that need to be developed. And unfortunately, I think the powers that be in Washington tend to look at the basic natural resources and feel, well, we have to do more to help in those areas. Well, that's fine, for perhaps a period of time, but ultimately that's going to be extremely expensive. It leaves us dependent on foreign oil. It's a depleting resource, which is an issue, and we're just not doing enough in the areas of alternative sources of fuel and conservation, all of which are going to need some help if we're ever going to get there. And they're too expensive right now, but we've got to continue the development. This bill didn't do this at all, and I don't think we're doing it as well as we should in Washington, D.C., and we cannot start waiving all the environmental laws. I happen to be in an East Coast state, Delaware, and obviously we inherit the air from the Midwest, and quite frankly, when they start to eliminate some of the requirements for the environment, it hurts us a great deal. And I just don't think that's something that can be done in the sake of having better energy policies. It doesn't make sense.
We'll hear later from a Midwestern congressman, Illinois' John Shimkus, who voted for and supported this legislation. Michael Castle, Delaware congressman, one of 13 Republicans who voted against the Gas Act. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're joined now from Washington by Jonathan Wiseman. He's congressional reporter for The Washington Post and watched this bill get pushed through the House last week. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. How are you?
Very well. First, to the scene there in the House, Democrats shouting shame, all kinds of knuckle-busting going on, it sounds like. How unusual was the pressure required to get this bill through?
Well, it's happened before. I mean, you remember that the Medicare prescription drug benefit, the vote took hours and hours until it was finally rounded up. So this wasn't a record, but it has been a while since we've seen this kind of arm twisting, and it was the first time we had a tough vote since the House Majority Leader Tom DeLay stepped down from his leadership post. So it was very instructive.
And Republicans managing to get it through, but it was a close thing. Let's look at the elements of this act. If you could walk us through them. I mean, for beginners, it limits the right of state or local governments to regulate or prohibit refinery construction. Have I got that correct?
That's right. And it also comes up, it also creates new incentives to create refineries. It even instructs the president to offer military bases for refiners to expand or build new refinery capacity.
Let's look at those incentives. They've been called giveaways by opponents and, necessary incentives by supporters. What do they look like?
Well, there's a lot of tax breaks, but mostly it's actually cutting back on regulation, streamlining environmental review process, things like that, things that do take a long time, and that many Republicans think are holding refiners back.
But a lot of local control and environmental maybe oversight stripped away. If that regulation or legal disputes take time, the refiners get reimbursed with tax dollars for
right.
that.
That's right. It gives the incentive to even go to court, because as the bill is written, if they go to court and the lawsuit is thrown out, it's frivolous. The refiners or the oil companies actually get reimbursed, which obviously would be a big incentive not to take them to court.
Right. And on the pollution front, there were even bigger environmental green lights or passes that were considered for this. As I understand it, it ends up that the number of gasoline blends, pollution-fighting blends around the country has been restricted by this legislation, or would be. Is that right?
That's right. What they're called boutique fuels. And actually, that's been an issue that's been around for a while, and it's not as controversial as you're making it sound. I think there are a lot of people, a lot of even environmentalists, who believe that it's gotten a little ridiculous that you have these tiny little islands like in Chicago and Atlanta that where you have a very specific blend of fuel necessary for clean air, to meet clean air standards. Mm-hmm. And there is a sense that perhaps we could streamline some of those boutique blends, have f- fewer of them and not really make much of a difference. The big controversy was that they wanted to streamline they wanted to codify what the Bush administration has been trying to do with something called New Source Review, which mm-hmm. is basically make it easier for the Clinton administration had tried to make it harder for basically mandate old power plants to create new pollution-saving devices when they try to upgrade their plants, and the Bush administration has argued that that's just kept them from upgrading their plants, so they wanted to make it easier for them to upgrade without having to put in huge, expensive new...
So has that requirement stayed or been stripped away here?
No, that has been... That actually was dropped. There was a recognition that the bill wouldn't pass at all with that, so that was dropped.
So that environmental kind of step back isn't there. I mean, on the other side, no new refinery since 76, and a lot of small ones have closed. Is there not a need here?
Nobody doubts that the lack of refinery capacity in this country is creating bottlenecks and helping to raise the price of gasoline. There is no question that basically twice a year, as we move from winter blends to summer blends and summer blends to winter blends, we get these refinery crunches and prices spike. Even when there's plenty of oil, you can't get through the refineries to the gasoline pump.
And yet tremendous resistance there last week for these changes pushed through in crunch time. Jonathan Wiseman with The Washington Post, thanks very much for your insights. Thanks for being with us. We're talking about the rushed energy bill squeaked through Congress last week, its new refineries, giveaways, and environmental impact. You can join us. Did you hear the bone cracking on Capitol Hill? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the energy bill squeaked through Congress last week, the so-called Gas Act and its new refineries, subsidies or giveaways, as you will, its environmental impact. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is Congress being responsive to the post-Katrina Rita energy crisis, or is it being reckless with local control, the environment, and federal funds? Are these important get-it-done subsidies for refinery construction, or are these giveaways to zillionaires? And this, are we now always going to be making energy policy in crisis? And how good will that policy be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined now from Washington by Ellen Berman, president of the Consumer Energy Council of America. Ellen Berman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington by Stephen Nadel, executive director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Stephen Nadel, thank you for being with us.
Glad to.
Ellen, first to you, lots of Americans looking at these predictions of very high home heating bills this winter, talking about maybe 50% more expensive gas and, of course, oil up too, and the prices at the pumps. For consumer impact, what do you see in the Gas Act? Is this going to be good for the people you represent in the energy equation?
Well, I think the real point is, what can consumers do this winter? The Gas Act itself is not going to affect this winter because nothing can happen that quickly, but consumers can take action themselves. They're being hit with the biggest shock since the Arab oil embargo in the 70s and the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. Prices are going way up, and the best thing consumers can do is to begin preparing themselves with measures that they can take which are extremely efficient in saving money on their heating bills.
So we can stuff newspapers in the window cracks and put the plastic over and the rest. But what about on the legislation front, Ellen? Is it wrong to expect something legislatively immediately to address that? We see people calling this the most dangerous winter, you know, since the 70s, borderline panic among some consumers about what the heating bill may be. Could we have expected Congress to address that more directly, or is that simply not the issue in this legislation?
Well, Congress can address that in the issue with the things that Congressman Castle was talking about for greater efficiency, greater mandates, but drilling is not going to have immediate results, and that's not the issue right now. There are longer-term measures that are highly more effective, that will save energy, that will create more efficient appliances, and consumers don't have to stuff paper in their windows. There are much more technology-oriented solutions that have longer-term results that give you hundreds of percent return on your dollar for investments you can make, like a night setback thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
You can make 20% on the cost of your heating by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But drilling on the U.S. coastline is not going to affect this winter's bills.
Nor will refinery construction, I guess, the direct focus of this bill. Stephen Nadel, we saw this kind of Donnybrook of pressure last year in the Capitol, in the House, to get this through. Why so much resistance when there is, I think by all accounts, a refining crunch in this country?
I think there were several reasons for the resistance. Before, as Jonathan Weissman pointed out, there were a lot of other parts of the bill, some rollbacks in environmental protections, some subsidies for oil companies that are doing quite well, wondering whether it was really needed. People do agree that we need more refining capacity, but their proposed solution, I don't think many people felt was the right answer.
Ellen, are you looking to Congress at all for relief in this winter, or is it all about individuals fending for themselves, making their own homes more efficient now?
No, we are looking for relief. And just to go back to what Steve was saying, there are measures Congress can do to look at the whole energy portfolio, not just production, but looking at how to make every fuel more efficient. And again, that can't happen this winter, because the lead times for new technologies are too long. But the solution is going to fall on the technology side, not simply on the production side. We need all kinds of fuels in the portfolio. The country is highly vulnerable to disruption in any single fuel, and we can't be dependent as a country on any single fuel.
So get your long johns on, tighten up the house as best you can technologically and otherwise, and hunker down for this winter. Ellen Berman at the Consumer Energy Council of America, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're joined now from Houston by Michael Economides. He's a petroleum expert and professor of engineering at the University of Houston, consults with governments and national oil companies. Michael Economides, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
I wish you'd give us the, I'm not sure what perspective, the industry or the kind of feet on the ground view of this bill passed last week. Is this going to increase American gasoline refining capacity, and how important, how big a deal is that for the energy crunch we're facing?
Well, it might, but it's not going to be something that it will happen overnight, as practically every one of your guests earlier on has discussed. I do think that is necessary, and I'm sure you also know that we have not had a new refinery in this country in 30 years.
Right.
And there's a very simple reason for that, by the way. It's the most unprofitable by far element of the energy chain.
So it's not environmental controls, or is that part of the reason it's unprofitable?
Well, it's all connected, but even if suddenly the Sierra Club were to today sign on this bill, I would be still skeptical that the largest multinationals would want to embark on huge refinery expansions because, for example, I tell people that if I have $2 billion today in my pocket, which
yes,
is really what you need to start a brand new refinery,
mm-hmm,
after you go through 800 permits and all of the other objections, by the time the refineries start making any money for me, I would double my money in exploration and production in Timbuktu.
So at these high oil prices, at these prices, get out there and put some drills down, do some exploring, not build a refinery. Stephen Nadel, what about with these subsidies? Will the subsidies make it attractive to oil companies to refine here in the United States?
My understanding is the economics have changed quite a bit, and more than $11 billion of investments have been announced by refinery companies recently in their public statements. Primarily what they're doing is expanding existing refineries, you know, like the Port Arthur Texas plant is mm-hmm. going to be doubling in capacity. So the economics have changed very recently, and there is going to be a lot of investment primarily to expand existing refineries because it's much easier to expand an existing refinery than to build on a green field. result.
Michael Economides, what do you think? I'm looking here at Tracy Gordon, refining manager for the American Petroleum Institute, saying that she's detected zero interest in building a new refinery in the United States. She's saying, let's build overseas. U.S. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman recommending overseas refineries cheaper to build there, and refiners can pollute to their heart's content. His words.
That's... I am closer to the second point of view than the previous one. I do think that there are going to be some expansion in U.S. Refineries, but it's all on existing refineries. And, you know, the analogy that I give with that to that is, I don't know if you've seen pictures of modern Havana, and most of the cars in Havana are 40s and 50s vintage cars that have been refurbished.
Sure, Cuba is sort of the great bastion of old-time American cars.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, nobody in their right mind thinks that that is comparable to a 2005 Lexus or Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same thing. Most of the refineries in the United States are very obsolete. They are. I have said long before Katrina and Rita that they are a disaster waiting to happen. Some of the recent events, like the BP refinery in Texas City.
The explosion there and deaths as a result.
It was not an accident, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you have...
Excuse me, did you say it was not an accident?
I don't think it was really an accident, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't. Really what does that mean? Does that mean... no, I don't know what that means.
I think that we are talking about extraordinarily obsolete, antiquated infrastructure in the refining business. Nobody in engineering believes that 40 or 50-year-old equipment in some cases, or even connectivity among equipment, is really sound enough to avoid disasters. And I think we're going to see a lot more before too long.
So you're saying we've just pushed this old jalopy infrastructure to the point of meltdown?
Yes, and it also doesn't make any money. I mean, it's the same analogy with the cars, okay? That is, an old dilapidated piece of equipment is not as attractive. And so the refining business has been left essentially to what I call second-tier companies like Valero. Certainly Valero is not an ExxonMobil in terms of its capacity. The other guest a few minutes ago discussed $11 billion, but you realize that is a drop in the bucket in the investment of the multinationals. We are talking about something on the order of 700 to 800, perhaps 800, 900 billion dollars in exploration and production. So the $11 billion we are discussing right now in refining is peanuts compared to the overall investment climate in the oil business.
And pretty soon, you're talking real money. We're looking at how energy policy is being shaped under the gun of crisis in the United States right now. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Baltimore. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Closer to Annapolis, actually. But
great.
First of all, I wish that I had that Congressman Castle as my representative instead of Gilchrist, who's just a giant George Bush rubber stamp. There's a whole lot of better things that could have been done with either this energy bill or the previous one that were passed. I guess the question I have, well, first a point, a lot of the fuel oil that gets refined in this country gets shipped overseas. So there's an artificial shortage being manufactured in this country. We're refining a lot more fuel oil. And in fact, the rate of export has gone up dramatically just in the past year.
Of course, on the other hand, so is the rate of import, so it stays tight here. I mean, you support Congressman Castle of Delaware, Jim, but what about the tight supply? I mean, you can see the result at the gas pumps. What's the country supposed to do? You hear Michael Economides saying we've got jalopy oil refineries, gas refineries, they're dangerous, they're exploding, and it's not in the economic interest of oil companies to get into that business. Exploration's more profitable, so doesn't the country have to do something?
Well, they're talking about using federal bases. Why don't we go whole hog and build a few refineries with federal dollars rather than hoping we can entice the big oil companies to build them themselves? But if we have a strategic oil reserve, why don't we have a strategic refining capacity to head off this potential disaster that the gentleman was
talking about here? It's a good question. Let us pick it up. Stephen Nadell, can you imagine state refining capacity, government refining capacity, or is that just off the American screen? Is it even a good idea?
I'm not sure, particularly in Washington, that there'd be a lot of support for government-owned.
No.
But I do think that if, instead of this gas bill, which I think had a lot of giveaways, there's something much more targeted toward, you know, a few refineries, particularly off the Gulf Coast, because we don't want to build more refineries on the Gulf Coast where
right.
they're going to be vulnerable to hurricanes. If they had something much more targeted, and they also matched it with something on the demand side, something to deal with improved automobile fuel economy, for example, then maybe they could get something passed. But they, I think, overreached strictly on the supply side, and that's why they're having these problems.
Michael Economides, what about it? What do you predict will result from this legislation in terms of refinery capacity? What might be built where, and will it solve the crunch and the aging infrastructure problem you're pointing to?
Not much. I think in the near future, I think we're going to see $5 gasoline before it goes down to $2.50. There are many other reasons. This is, I call, two perfect storms, level five, superposed on each other. Certainly, some of the environmental issues of the past several years will come back and haunt us. Ultimately, it's a philosophical question, what kind of society we want to have, what type of mobility we would like to have. I think of myself as quite neutral when it comes to government policy. It's always too little, too late, always reflecting crisis rather than forecasting and anticipating issues. California will certainly see $5 gasoline before next year.
Why is that? Why just California?
Because of some specific issues local, like the MTBE requirement to remove the additive from gasoline.
Right, that pollutant they want out, that's going to be expensive. $5
yeah.
gas in California, does that mean gas heading that way for the rest of the country as well?
Well, certainly, because the analogy that I use is that if you look at the carcass of a beef, California is suddenly saying only prime filet will do. They can never eat hamburger in California, which would be the one with the additives. One of the things that people forget, by the way, is that MTBE has been a replacement for tetraethyl lead, the leaded gasoline.
Right.
So we solved a huge, enormous problem with a far more benign problem, but once we don't accept that, because there is always a risk with something, there is a price to pay, and it's very simple. You cannot have it two ways, in other words.
And yet there's a price for MTBE and long-term pollution as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Harry is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is related to politics, in that the reason we legislate things under a crisis is because then the politicians basically have their behinds covered. If they tried to do things ahead of time, for example, not waxing off on the CAFE standards and keep increasing the CAFE standards back in the 80s and 90s, then we would have had all this, you know, our gas consumption wouldn't have risen as much as it had, and therefore the refinery crisis wouldn't have been as bad.
So a crisis of our own making through lack of foresight. It's a good point, Harry. Thank you very much for calling. Stephen Nidell, how about it? Self-made crisis here. Is it a fair critique?
I think it's partly fair. Yes, we could have done a lot more sooner. A lot of people saw this coming, but Congress tends to react only to crises. They weren't prepared to make the compromises necessary before, so we could have anticipated it and made this crisis far smaller.
Michael Economides, there they are, out making big money on oil right now and going toward exploration, as you say. Is it too much to expect the big oil companies to also invest in the refineries, not be so reluctant? Is it just... If exploration there's more market incentive for it, is it then necessary to subsidize, or can't we expect with those huge profits that them to also invest in refining if we need it?
Well, I think the market will have a tendency to serve itself. I mean, to solve the problem. But just to answer the point that was brought up, even with increased CAFE standards, that is, even if the CAFE standards increased to twice as much.
Yes.
Our forecast over the next 15 years, we will still need 4 million barrels a day more, even if you double, which is the most extraordinary increase that anybody could ever anticipate. The reason for that is that the economy requires more and more driving, and it's not just the profligacy that some people assume that people are driving around from their home to the gym. We have transportation issues, There are most people think that we waste energy in this country. I don't believe any of that. It's true that the rich country will use more energy.
But the times, they are changing. We hear that. We've got to take a short break here. Stephen Nadel, Michael Economides, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. How do you read Republican resistance to this bill? And can the country harness crisis for good long-term energy policy? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the energy bill squeaked through Congress last week, about its new refineries, subsidies, giveaways, and environmental impact, about really crisis mode energy policy and how it looks so far. We're at 1-800-423-8255, joined in this hour by Stephen Nadel, Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, and from Houston by Michael Economides, Petroleum Expert Professor of Engineering at the University of Houston. We hope to hear in a few minutes from Congressman John Shimkus of Illinois as well, a big supporter of this bill, but he's to call in from Riga, Latvia, of all places, and so far that line's not open. We'll keep trying. You can join us. Mark is calling from North Beach, Maryland. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. What do you think, Mark?
What I can't understand is why everybody on all sides in the political sphere keep ignoring the real reason why we're in this shortage situation, which is that both markets and governments massively overreacted to the oil price shocks of the 1970s and created by the 1980s a massive glut, which gave us 15 years of depressed prices and all the culture that goes along with glut.
Less exploration, less capacity built. So what do you take from that, Mark?
And by the way, that's also true with refining capacity.
Right.
Contrary to some of the things that have said, if you read the report, the 1993 report of the National Petroleum Council, it was all about the crisis in refining capacity, meaning excess capacity.
Cut to the chase with us, then. If you're right, and no doubt there was a big reaction, what should we learn from that?
We should learn the importance of taking measures to stabilize on the long term, you know, better cooperation between consuming and producing countries. We should not focus, as everybody is, even after these hurricanes, we still hear energy policy phrased in terms of reducing reliance on imported oil, meaning making Middle Eastern capacity redundant. And we should focus on, you know, contingency plans for shortages, things like that, trying to stabilize a long-term growth of long-term management of consumption and production so that neither one, you know, runs too far ahead of the other.
Yeah, it's a big goal, and of course the how of that is the difficult piece here. Mark, thanks for your call. Michael Economides, what about this issue of imports, and particularly of refined fuel imports and exports? I've read here concern that the U.S. is becoming increasingly reliant on overseas refineries. It's a globalized economy. Does it matter where the refineries are?
Yes and no. From an economic vantage point, it probably doesn't. It may be better. But there is an issue of security. There are a whole bunch of countries out there that are acting in a militant way towards the West and the United States, both from the consumption side. China has gone berserk, make no mistake.
Berserk on what front?
China is going to be the biggest consuming incrementally energy nation in the world, by far.
A status we've held for a long time, so it's hard to point fingers, but they are certainly booming.
Well, they have gone way out of line the last couple of years, 20% per year increase. And then, of course, you have Venezuela in our hemisphere, which is really problematic in many ways. This has nothing to do with how much President Bush likes President Chavez or vice versa, or hate each other. The fact of the matter is that Venezuela has become very assertive. You want to talk about a disaster, imagine if Venezuela stop selling crude oil to their own subsidiary, Citgo, in the United States,
mm-hmm.
the price of gasoline will hit $10 a gallon overnight, I think, and this is not an exaggeration. So we are vulnerable for security vantage point. From an economic vantage point, I think we can coast along and we can still be importing refined products from everywhere we can get our hands on.
Stephen Nadel, what about the location of this new refinery capacity, if and when it comes? Do you see it, A, as likely to come in this vulnerable Gulf region, even though we've seen what can happen there? And, B, do you expect these the local or state objections to be overridden because of the provisions of this bill? Will it be forced down the throats of communities where it's built?
I think most of the current plans to expand refinery capacity would tend to be along the Gulf Coast. It would tend to be existing refineries. There's one proposal in Arizona, but that's the only one I'm aware of off the Gulf Coast.
Is that crazy, or is that just what makes sense economically because the infrastructure is there, the pipeline mouths are there to receive it?
Both. I mean, I think we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket, and we do need to have capacity elsewhere. But there are short-term economic interests to say it's much cheaper to build something, to expand something, to build something new.
And so we go right back in the Gulf. That's kind of amazing in itself, but you see it happening there.
Yes, I do. You also asked about whether, you know, these subsidies will force the refineries elsewhere. I don't think this bill is going to pass, so it's a little bit more academic.
Because the Senate is not likely to do it. Who's opposed there? What are the interests lined up there?
I mean, in the Senate, you need to get 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. The Senate has been more moderate on energy issues, and they're just not going to go there. I doubt they even have 50 votes, let alone 60 votes. What they're going to have to do in the Senate is a much more balanced bill, one that balances the demand side and the supply side, that mm-hmm. does something about oil use as well as oil refining, and it'll be significantly scaled back, I think, compared to what the House does.
So, Michael Economides, if that's the way it goes, and I see even your Houston Chronicle down there in refining land is opposed to this House bill, they say the Senate should reject it. If it's rejected, if it's something without these quite the same subsidies and overrides, are we going to get the refinery capacity we need or not?
I doubt it.
What are the implications of that? We're going to go along with this aging capacity, and then what?
I would say we are going to go until the American public cries uncle on the prices that they're going to pay. Now, I think my own estimates is that the price of gasoline is going to have to go a lot higher before that point is reached. Perhaps $7, $8 a gallon is not unthinkable in my mind, because you have heard the inflation-adjusted statements, but there is also something else, something we call energy intensity. What fraction of the spendable income do we spend on energy? It has declined by 50% since 1973. So when you factor those things, I think we have a lot of cushion. Yes, people are going to call in talk shows and things like that and complain, mm-hmm. and politicians will posture and make positions, and you can talk about uses and conservation and all of those other things we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. We get today the same things. But the fact of the matter is that I don't think we have reached the breaking point yet, and it's unfortunate. We don't anticipate that's going to happen. It will happen. Perhaps we need a shock therapy before things happen.
Shock therapy may do what even with this legislation you think may not. Michael Economides in Houston and Stephen Nadel in Washington, please stand by. We are joined now by Congressman John Shimkus, Republican congressman for Illinois' 19th District. He joins us from Riga, Latvia. Congressman Shimkus, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you. I'm sorry I'm late.
It's just fine. We heard earlier from Michael Castle, a fellow Republican who opposed this bill. You voted for it. Why?
Well, the reality is we haven't built a new refinery in our country since I graduated from high school in 1976. Yes, our refineries are more efficient, but I think most Americans would find it pretty confusing and embarrassing that we actually import refined product. We lose everything when we do that. We lose the local tax base. We lose the jobs. And the hurricanes have shown that all our refineries, well, not all of them, but 40% of them are located in a hurricane alley, which we, you know, really can't afford to have them so centralized in one location. We need a dispersal aspect. And that's why this legislation was very important.
Congressman, how will the country get that dispersal aspect? We're hearing from Stephen Adell and Michael Economides this morning that if it passes, the Senate ultimately, if it encourages new refinery capacity at all, it's very likely to go right back to the Gulf Coast. How would that be avoided?
Well, we do want to encourage either new refineries or expansion of old refineries. So the fact that we import 4 million gallons of refined product, I mean, we don't get the market value based upon that. We can ask Saudi to give us all the additional oil they can, but if we can't refine it, they laugh at us because we've got to be able to refine the product. There's another provision here that was very important that's not talked a lot about, is the future of coal to liquid. Fischer-Tropsch refineries, that was an amendment I added to make sure that was considered as a refinery. With the price of a barrel of oil, you could actually turn coal into fuel, do that in the Midwest or in the coal basins around our country, have the refineries there. You get the benefits of the decrease in the dependence on imported crude oil, and you get the refinery base.
Congressman, we've just got a minute here. You're on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Why was it so darn hard to get this through with your Republican majority in the House? Why the holdouts?
Well, it was really our moderates, that's what we expected our moderates to move in that direction. What happened was because of politics and other problems that we have in Washington, the Democrats were able to hold even their most ardent pro-business Democrats in line on a partisan vote, and that's what made it difficult.
But you had Republicans who resisted as well. Why?
Well, we always have Republicans. We always have moderates like Mike Castle, who's a good friend of mine from New England, who are of the mind that, you know, you really don't need to develop new energy resources. We're just going to magically cause it to appear. But usually on a vote like that in the refinery bill of 2 years ago, we had like 30 to 40 Democrats. I mean, we got, I don't know, probably none. And it was really more of a political statement than public policy.
Congressman John Shimkus of Illinois joining us from Riga today. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Economides, last thought goes to, we've just got half a minute here. Where does all this leave us? You say it's going to be crunch time and then super high prices and then what?
I think we need to sit back and think about where the country needs to go, not just the next 3 years, over the next 40 years. And I think you cannot talk about energy independence unless you address the transportation issue. This in itself is the subject that you probably need to talk about a whole hour some other time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really think we have to have a holistic approach to the problem. The recent energy bill was too little, too late, too ridiculous to solve any of these problems. And this current gasoline bill is even worse, I think. I mean, it's just stopgap measures upon stopgap measures. We have to rethink it all over the place.
Too little, too late, too ridiculous, and time to think big. Michael Economides at the University of Houston, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for joining us this hour. And Stephen Nadel, let me ask you, do you go away with, I don't know, optimism, pessimism? How are you looking on the moment here?
I'm somewhat pessimistic. I agree with Michael Economides that most likely we're going to not do much here in Washington, not do much with policy. We're going to let prices determine. Prices will gradually go higher or steeply go higher. There'll be a lot of dislocations, and ultimately, through a crisis, we'll have to deal with this.
And bar the door. Here we go. We're out of time with that, Stephen Nadel. We're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks for joining us.
Certainly.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. This is On Point. Fabled Cape Cod, Massachusetts, has been novelist Anne Bernays' home away from home for decades. In that time, she's watched her favorite town, Truro, transform from a sleepy backwater, as she calls it, to a vacation hotspot full of massive second homes of the faraway rich. Bernays doesn't like the transformation. In her new book, Trophy House, Anne Bernays takes readers to Cape Cod and tells a story of how easily foundations can crack in both a big house and in a shaky marriage.
I've been going to Cape Cod in Truro, which is a very rural community, for 30-odd years. And it's always been very laid-back, very sort of non-ostentatious. And then suddenly, about 10 years ago, sort of Hamptons crowd started coming in, people who drove huge Beamers and started building houses so out of scale that they made their neighbors look like outhouses or little shacks. And ostentation had come to Truro, and it really bothered me. I thought it was an insult to the community and an insult to the land itself. Now, here's a woman who the main character, Danny Faber, her life, she begins to think of it as a graph gone flat. That is her marriage. And she takes the trophy house down the beach, a huge monstrosity of a house with an obnoxious owner, as a kind of sign that things are not going the way they should. In the passage that I'll read, the woman telling the story is Danny Faber. She is married to Tom. Beth is the daughter. Tom is just about to leave to go back to his teaching job, and Danny gets up to make breakfast for him and then realizes that she doesn't miss him after he goes, that it makes absolutely no difference to her whether he's there or not. Beth was still asleep when I got up at 6 the next morning with Tom, brewed a pot of coffee, and scrambled some eggs. The eggs came from one of the few working farms left on the Outer Cape. I find it peculiar how we adhere to these old-fashioned emblems, eggs dropped directly into our palms, organically grown broccoli, well water, shampoo made with distilled essence of something, as if they made any real difference in our lives, already so fraught with risk. Cars hurtling down Route 6. I knew personally 4 people killed on the spot in Route 6 accidents. Maniacs with mini atom bombs inside suitcases, AIDS. Fresh from the farm, I told Tom as I served them up with 6-grain bread and homemade blueberry preserves, homemade by someone else. After he left, I realized that my spirits, pretty bright that morning, were no different after Tom left. I didn't mind his leaving. This frightened me, that some kind of worm had crawled into the apple was a reality I couldn't ignore. When a marriage goes sour, it doesn't do it all at once. It does it over days, weeks, months, maybe years, so gradually that you're not sure you're not imagining things. My cousin Caroline, a woman I rarely see anymore, precisely because of what she said to me that the reason Tom and I stayed married when everyone else seemed to be on their second or third spouse was that we were apart so much. You're not lovebirds at all, Caroline told me. You're ships that pass in the night. And I hadn't asked for her opinion. I sent her a postcard. Congratulations. You've just won our Tactless Remark of the Month award. You have been automatically entered in our annual contest. The next time I saw her, she pretended not to see me.
Novelist Anne Bernays reading from her new book, Trophy House. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.